The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, if you've ever just stopped and looked at a really incredible sunset, or maybe felt that sort of shiver looking up at a clear night sky full of stars, well, you've basically touched on what we're diving into today, Immanuel Kant's critique of judgment.
It's really the final piece of his huge philosophical puzzle, a fascinating book. Kant had already tackled what he saw as the two massive domains. First, the world of nature, you know, physics, cause and effect, all governed by necessity.
Right, the stuff science studies.
Exactly. And second, the world of freedom, morality, ethics, our inner sense of ought.
Okay, but isn't there a huge tension there? I mean, how can we be just physical objects following laws of nature and at the same time be these free agents making moral choices? That feels like a contradiction.
That's precisely the problem Kant saw. He called it a great gulf, separating these two realms. How do you connect the determined world of science with the free world of morality?
So we need some kind of bridge.
We do. And our mission today is to get a quick, solid understanding of Kant's argument that it's our faculty of judgment, specifically how we experience beauty and see purpose in things, that acts as this crucial bridge. He thinks it unites our whole experience and gives us a framework for meaning.
Wow. Okay. So finding something beautiful isn't just a nice feeling. It's like tapping into the structure of reality. Let's maybe start with the man himself, Kant.
Right. Immanuel Kant lived 1724 to 1804. He's pretty much central to the Enlightenment. Hugely influential, incredibly systematic thinker. He really changed the game for how we think about knowledge, ethics, even art.
And this book we're looking at, The Critique of Judgment, it wasn't his first major work, was it?
No, not at all. It builds on the first two critiques. First came the critique of pure reason. That basically set up the world of nature, arguing our minds actually structure how we experience reality, things like time, space, causality. That's what makes science possible, but it kind of locks us into that determined, phenomenal world.
Okay, so that's the nature side.
Then came the critique of practical reason. That established the other side, freedom, morality. That's where we get his famous categorical imperative, the idea that you should act in a way you'd want everyone else to act universally. But crucially, these two systems, nature and freedom, they seemed almost entirely separate.
Which is why this third critique is so key. He wasn't just tacking on some thoughts about art. He saw it as essential to completing his whole philosophical system, showing that human reason is actually unified. He needed to explain those experiences that seemed to fall right in that gap, feeling beauty or sensing purpose in a living thing.
Exactly. The critique of judgment essentially argues that our faculty of judgment has this unique power to find purposiveness, a sense of fittingness in the world. But to really get it, we need to understand the two types of judgment Kant talks about. One is pretty straightforward. The other is where the magic happens.
Okay, this sounds important for listeners to grasp. What are these two types?
Well, first, there's determinate judgment. This is what we do all the time, especially in science. You have a general rule or a concept already in your head, say, bird. Then you see a particular thing flapping around.
And you say, that's a bird.
Right. You apply the existing rule to the specific case. The concept bird determines how you see that particular object. Simple categorization.
Makes sense. Standard operating procedure. But the real focus of this book is the other kind.
Reflective judgment, yes. This works the other way around. You encounter something particular, maybe a really striking abstract painting or a weird plant you've never seen before. You don't have a ready-made concept for it.
So you have to search.
You have to search. You reflect, trying to find some kind of underlying principle or concept that makes sense of this particular thing. You're looking for a feeling of harmony, a sense that this thing fits somehow, even without a clear label. And Kant says, when that search is successful, when the object seems perfectly suited to how our minds work.
That's when we feel pleasure.
That's the feeling of aesthetic pleasure, yes. Or in other cases, it's the perception of purpose. It's the feeling that arises from the successful interplay of our mental faculties, imagination, and understanding sparked by the object.
Okay, so the pleasure comes from our minds successfully making sense of something complex and new. And the book divides this reflective process.
Right, into two main parts. First, aesthetic judgment, which deals with beauty and the sublime feelings. And second, teleological judgment, which is about perceiving purpose or design, especially in nature. The big goal is to show that nature isn't hostile or indifferent to us, but actually seems kind of set up or pre-adapted for our minds and even our moral goals.
Let's dive into that aesthetic side first, then. Sounds like that's where the really revolutionary ideas about art come in. What's the first big concept?
The first moment, as Kant calls it, is disinterestedness. This is crucial.
Disinterestedness. Okay, so if I see, say, a beautiful painting, and my first thought is, wow, that would look great over my sofa, or I wonder how much that's worth, that's saying that's not really aesthetic judgment.
Not the pure kind, no. True aesthetic judgment has to be free from any personal interest. That means separating your appreciation of the object's form from any desire to own it, use it, eat it, whatever. It's not about satisfying a personal need or desire.
So loving a delicious meal is agreeable because I want to eat it, but appreciating a beautiful arrangement of food on the plate just for its visual harmony without wanting to devour it immediately, that could be closer to aesthetic judgment.
Exactly. You're appreciating the form itself detached from its utility or its ability to satisfy a craving. This disinterestedness is what allows the judgment to feel universal because it's not based on your specific personal desires.
Okay, that leads us somewhere interesting. You mentioned this core paradox, purposiveness without a purpose, or finality without an end. That still sounds pretty confusing. If something looks like it has a purpose, how can it not have one?
Think about something like a beautiful seashell, or maybe just the pattern frost makes on a window. It looks designed. Everything seems perfectly placed, intentional. There's a definite sense of purpose or rightness to its form.
Yeah, like it couldn't be any other way.
Exactly. But can you actually state a definite external function that form serves? What's the purpose of that specific spiral on the shell, beyond just being part of the shell? For the aesthetic judgment, the object appears perfectly suited to some end, but we can't pin down what that end is. The purpose seems internal to the form itself.
I think I'm getting it. The pleasure isn't about figuring out what it's for, but comes from the feeling that its form just perfectly resonates with how my mind wants to organize things. It's like my imagination and understanding are playing together nicely, prompted by the object.
That's a great way to put it. It's the free play, the harmony of our cognitive faculties. And because Kant assumes we all share this basic cognitive setup, he argues that we expect others to feel that same harmony when looking at the same object. That's the basis for claiming universal taste.
Okay, that's beauty. But then Kant throws in something even more intense, the sublime. How is that different from the beautiful?
If beauty is about harmony, form, and a kind of calm pleasure, the sublime is about disharmony, formlessness, and, initially at least, kind of overwhelming feeling, even fear or awe. It pushes our minds to their limits. Kant identifies two main types.
All right, what's the first?
The mathematical sublime. This happens when we encounter something of overwhelming magnitude. Think about looking up at the seemingly infinite starry sky or standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon. Our imagination tries to grasp the sheer scale, but it just fails. It can't take it all in.
Yeah, you feel tiny, insignificant.
You do. But then, Kant says, our reason steps in. Reason can conceive of the idea of infinity or absolute totality, even if our senses and imagination can't picture it. So there's this moment of displeasure, our imagination failing quickly, followed by a kind of pleasure in realizing our rational capacity transcends the limits of our senses. It's awe mixed with a sense of our own rational power.
Okay, a pleasure born from almost being mentally overwhelmed. What's the second type?
The dynamical sublime. This is about encountering overwhelming power. Think of a massive hurricane, a huge waterfall, an earthquake, things that can easily destroy us physically.
Right, pure force of nature. Terrifying.
It is. We feel our physical vulnerability, our powerlessness against these forces. But Kant argues in that very moment, we can become aware of something inside us that isn't subject to physical nature, our moral self, our rational will. We realize that even if nature can crush our bodies, it can't touch our capacity for moral freedom and dignity.
So the storm outside highlights the strength inside. Both sublime experiences, then, point beyond the physical world.
Absolutely. They affirm our supersensible nature, our connection to the realm of freedom and reason, which stands above mere physical existence.
Okay, so aesthetic judgment connects our feelings about form and power back to our inner rational moral selves. That's the bridge on the aesthetic side. What about the other part of the book, teleological judgment? How does seeing purpose in nature, like in a living thing, build this bridge?
Right, so now we shift focus from art and feeling to the natural world, especially living organisms. Think about something complex like a bird's wing or even just a simple blade of grass. Kant says we can't help but see them as having a purpose.
Yeah, a wing is for flying, a plant is for growing and reproducing.
Exactly. but it's deeper than just assigning a function. Kant calls organisms natural purposes. Unlike a machine, like a watch, where the parts are put together by an external designer for an external purpose, in an organism, the parts seem to exist for each other.
How do you mean?
Well, think of a tree. The leaves exist to help the tree photosynthesize, right? But the tree, the whole system, exists to produce and support the leaves. Each part is both a means and an end for the other parts. The organism is self-organizing, self-maintaining, self-reproducing, in a way a machine isn't.
Okay, I see the difference. It's an internal, reciprocal purposefulness. But science usually tries to explain things just through mechanical causes, chemistry, physics. Doesn't seeing purpose conflict with that?
It certainly feels like a conflict. We seem forced to think about organisms in terms of purpose, teleology, to even understand them properly. But science demands we explain them through non-purposive mechanisms. This is another one of those Kantian tensions in antinomy.
So how does he resolve it? Do we just pick one? Mechanism or purpose?
No, Kant's solution is clever. He says mechanism and teleology aren't competing descriptions of how nature objectively is. Instead, they are two different but equally necessary regulative principles for our understanding. Think of them as indispensable tools for inquiry.
So like two different lenses we need to use to get the full picture?
Pretty much. We absolutely need mechanistic explanation to figure out the how photosynthesis works at a chemical level, for instance. Okay. But we also need the teleological principle, viewing the organism as if it were designed for a purpose, to understand the why, to see how all the parts work together as a coherent functional system. It helps us organize our investigation.
Okay, so we use both. We study the mechanics, but we frame it within a sense of purpose to make sense of the whole biological system.
Exactly. And this idea that nature exhibits this internal purposiveness, especially in life, leads Kant to ask, well, is there an ultimate purpose to nature as a whole system? If everything seems organized, what's the final goal?
And that brings us back to us, doesn't it? He concludes the ultimate purpose is human beings as moral agents.
That's his conclusion, yes. Because only humans, through our reason and freedom, can conceive of purposes and act according to them. We're the only beings in nature who can set goals based on a concept of what ought to be. So for Kant, the entire intricate setup of nature, from its capacity to produce beauty that engages our minds, to its fostering of life that we study teleologically, ultimately finds its highest purpose in making possible the existence and development of rational moral beings.
Wow. So the feeling you get from a sunset and the intricate design of an eye socket are both, in a way, pointing towards the possibility of human morality and culture. It all connects.
That's the grand vision, which leads us nicely into the key themes. The first, clearly, is this unity of reason. This third critique isn't an afterthought. It's the keystone that locks his whole system together, showing how our scientific understanding, our moral life, and our aesthetic feelings are all interconnected aspects of one unified human reason.
And the second theme you mentioned earlier, subjective universality and sensus communis. Our feeling of beauty is personal, subjective, yet we feel it should be universal. We argue about art.
Right. And Kant grounds this claim in the idea of a sensus communis, literally a common sense, but meaning a shared human capacity for this kind of reflective judgment. The assumption that others can feel the same harmony we do is what underpins shared culture, communication about values, and, well, art criticism.
Okay, and a third theme?
I'd say it's the sheer power and importance of reflective judgment itself. This isn't just some niche activity for art critics. It's fundamental to being human. It's that constant process of encountering the new, the unexplained, and actively searching for patterns, connections, and meaning where no rule is given beforehand.
So it's basically critical thinking, problem solving, innovation.
All of that. It's how we learn, how we make discoveries, how we make sense of a complex world.
Kant really did have a way of boiling these huge ideas down. You mentioned some memorable lines.
He certainly did. They really captured the essence.
How about this one defining beauty? Beauty is the form of the purposiveness of an object, so far as this is perceived in it, without any representation of a purpose.
That's it in a nutshell, isn't it? The core paradox. It looks like it's for something perfectly designed, but you can't actually name an external goal or function. It's that appearance of purpose in the form itself that delights our minds.
And for the sublime. The sublime is that, the mere ability to think which shows a faculty of the mind surpassing every standard of sense.
Yeah, that captures the feeling perfectly. Faced with overwhelming size or power that dwarfs our senses, the very fact that our mind, our reason, can think beyond those limits confirms our superior non-physical capacity. It turns potential fear into awe and a recognition of our inner strength.
He also had a fascinating idea about genius, didn't he? Saying it's the talent through which nature gives the rule to art.
Right. Genius isn't just being skillful or following existing rules well. For Kant, true artistic genius is about originality that stems from tapping into this natural harmony in a new way. The genius creates works that become the new standard, the new rule, because they resonate so deeply with that shared sensus communis. They don't just imitate, they originate.
Okay, let's bring this down to earth a bit. How can we actually use these ideas today?
Well, take disinterested attention. You can actively practice this to refine your own appreciation of art or even nature. Next time you see something you find beautiful, consciously try to set aside thoughts like, do I like this? Would I buy this? What does it remind me of? Just focus purely on the form, the lines, the colors, the composition itself. Try to feel that harmony Kant talks about. It can shift your experience from just liking something to a deeper contemplation.
That makes sense. And the teleological idea, seeing purpose in nature.
That has huge implications for environmental stewardship. If we shift from seeing nature as just a collection of resources, purely mechanically, to viewing ecosystems as if they are purposeful, self-organizing systems, well, it naturally fosters a deeper respect, doesn't it? You start to see the interconnectedness and the intrinsic value, not just the utility value.
Right. It encourages a less exploitative view.
And psychologically, understanding the sublime can be quite empowering. Recognizing that confronting things that feel overwhelming, whether it's a huge challenge, a natural disaster, or even just contemplating vastness, can actually affirm your inner strengths, your rational freedom, your moral core, that can help turn fear or anxiety into a sense of resilience and dignity.
Looking back on all this, what really strikes me is how Kant kind of validates our feelings. That jolt of pleasure from seeing something beautiful or that feeling of awe. It's not just fluff. He argues it's actually a signal, a rational experience, confirming the whole structure that makes morality possible. He connects subjective feeling to objective meaning.
That's absolutely key. For me, the most valuable takeaway is that these feelings of beauty, of purpose, of the sublime, they aren't just quirks of our psychology. They're fundamental clues about how our reason works, how he unifies our experience of the world. Kant essentially gives us permission to trust that these feelings point towards something deep and meaningful about our place in the cosmos.
So the final thought for you, the listener, might be this. Kant suggests we're not just passively receiving meaning from the world. Through this act of reflective judgment, finding beauty, sensing purpose, grappling with the sublime, we are actively participating in making the world meaningful. We are co-creators of significance. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.